This episode is sponsored by Datadog. With 350-plus integrations, as well as metrics, logs, traces, and APM, Datadog enables your team to quickly find and fix issues before they escalate. Visualize your microservices architecture with a service map, spot unusual trends with a log patterns view, and monitor the availability of your services with Synthetics. Start a free 14-day trial of Datadog today and receive a complimentary t-shirt by visiting bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. That's bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. This is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Upuli Divisekara. She's working on her PhD in nanotechnology and all things small, as well as things like synthetic biology. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm lovely, and I'm talking to you from Portland, and it's midnight, and you're in Australia?
I'm actually in Auckland, New Zealand.
In New Zealand. Oh, because you've moved. You're originally an Australian, and you're in New Zealand right now?
Yep, that's right.
All right. Well, thanks for taking the time and dealing with all the time zone changes.
My pleasure. I'm not particularly good at dealing with time zones.
I don't think anyone is. I've noticed online, as you talk about science and nanotechnology, that some people have challenged you that nanotechnology isn't a thing. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I do know how to use the Google. And Google indicates that nanotechnology is, in fact, a thing. Is this a controversy? Is there confusion about whether or not nanotechnology is a useful and applied science?
I'd say that if there's controversy, it's pretty mild. And, you know, if nanotechnology isn't a real thing, then there's a range of universities and institutes that probably need to have a name change, if that's the case. I think some of the opposition to the term nanotechnology has arisen from a few things. Firstly, a sense of perhaps that it's hype, but that it's actually not a separate subject. It's just an applied subject. There's also some skepticism about it because it was used as a term, as one scientist put it, to get grant funding, to obtain a lot of grant funding under this idea of nanotech being the next frontier. And that it has borne very little fruit. But at the same time, I would say that it's definitely a real thing, mm-hmm. not simply because I'm biased, but it's a real thing because it refers to the kind of branch of material science, of chemistry, and a range of other disciplines. So it's a multidisciplinary area that uses a whole mm-hmm. bunch of techniques to create new devices and new materials that work in both organic circumstances and inorganic circumstances, so both in living things and in non-living things, to create all kinds of new devices.
I see. So it's a wide enough term that it can refer to the sizes of something. Like I know what a meter is, and I understand that a nanometer is a billionth of a meter, and there must be lots of things that are that small.
Exactly. So there's a lot of things that are that small. So, you know, so it's sort of like the joke is, well, what about pico technology? Well, I think that's called chemistry. So it's really that the way that materials behave at a certain scale, at the nanoscale, is different and unique to the way that it behaves at other scales. So anything, say, smaller than about 1 nanometer or bigger than about 100 nanometers or, say, a few hundred nanometers, the material will behave differently. And the best example that I can give you of that is that gold at the macroscopic level is this shiny yellow, orangey-yellow color. Mm-hmm. You know, you can pull it into wires. You can beat it into very, very thin gold leaf. You can do all sorts of things about with it. It has a very low, relatively low melting temperature for a metal. But when you have gold nanoparticles, they look completely different, and they're often in suspension. And rather than looking like the gold that we see in jewelry, they're actually red solutions of red particles or green particles, and it just looks like a green liquid or a brown liquid or a red liquid. And that's because the size and the shape of gold nanoparticles interferes with light in a way that it doesn't interfere at the macroscopic level.
Is it gold, though?
It is still gold, and that's what's amazing. You know, like we use an acid of gold, and we just use chemistry to generate these gold particles. And so what happens is that because they're so small, they can interfere with the wavelengths of light, and the way that they react with light is so different. And so that's why they have different colors, and it also depends on their shape. So gold nanoparticles that are about 20 to 30 nanometers in diameter tend to have a solution of them, or a colloidal suspension of them is the technical term. It tends to be a really nice sort of bright, almost blood red, a really bright red. And so it's more like a Pinot Noir. And when you go up to about 40 nanometers, it's like a claret. Or if you go even higher to about 50 nanometers, it's like a Merlot. It's really dark and a little bit purplish as well. But if you have nanostars, they're often the solution is green. But if you have pyramids, the solution can be brown. So the way that they interact with the light as a material is completely different to the way that they interact with light as a bulk substance.
Wow, that would really make one question kind of reality itself. I mean, we already question how light is a thing because it's part of a visible electromagnetic spectrum. Right. Like, so we can always ask you, like, is your red the same as my red? Exactly. But now you're telling me that something that I want to count on, which is that gold is gold, I can't even count on that.
Yeah, it depends on the size. The gold powder that I use to make the solution is just yellow. It's not like a nice shimmery gold. But some of my colleagues have found that if we centrifuge down our particles and we do it too hard, they tend to clump together. And they found that it actually starts to take on more of a gold color once a lot of them clump together at once. So you can get back to that point. It's just that weird things happen at these smaller scales. And so we want to make use of that. So, for example, you can actually make nanoparticles that will convert energy from infrared to a much higher level, like, say, going from about 600 to 700, even 500 nanometers as infrared, I think. And then it will convert it down to, say, blue light. And that light has a lot more energy, and it can do things like break chemical bonds. So if you shine a laser on it, on those particles, and they're usually made of semiconductors and they're doped with different kinds of metals, you can actually use infrared laser, which is much lower energy. It doesn't burn you, and it can penetrate through the skin to a certain depth. And if you've got, say, a particle implanted, you can actually convert that energy to a higher form of energy like blue light. Or you can convert it to heat, so you convert it down from infrared to just heat. And it can be used to generate heat to destroy tissues that you want to get rid of, or it can be used to emit light so that you can, say, use it as a marker for MRI.
Ah, interesting. So you're saying that the changes – the way that things behave when they are smaller can allow us to change things when they are bigger as we filter them through these smaller things. You could affect glass, you could affect lenses, you can affect lasers. You could use this to, you know, not to jump to the next thing, but you could cure cancer with this because you are you're getting down to the tiniest particles and changing the way the things that we use at the largest size behave fundamentally.
So to some extent, so what we're saying is that we can use these amazing properties to do things like treat cancer, or to use them as better detectors, or like, say, we want to find a cancer in someone, or we want to see if there's secondary cancers. We can mark those particles with a targeting molecule and say inject them, and that we can then use MRI to see if we can pick up those particles and where they might be, and because those particles will then interact, they'll emit either a bit more light or they'll show some density, then you can use them to detect things.
When something is so small, I mean, I don't think you're not talking about like having one or two nanoparticles. You made the term nanosphere. Are we talking about solutions of millions or billions of these particles?
That's right. Millions. Well, usually thousands of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We can create several thousand, hundreds of thousands of them in a small tube, relatively small tube, like 50 mils. Mm-hmm. You know, that can be used for generating all kinds of nanoparticles that are useful to us.
Is everything, when it gets this small, a sphere, or can something be nanoparticle sized and be a, like you said, a pyramid or a square or a cube?
It can be whatever size you want it to be. So that's one of the great things about nanotech, is that when you're making nanoparticles, you can, you know, the way that we make things at the macro level is, say we might have a mold and then we pour some plastic into it or some metal, and you might, you know, shave off the uneven bits. Even in 3D printing, when you're printing, you have all these other little bits that you need to kind of cut off and smooth the final product. But with nanoparticles and many other kinds of nanoparticles, what you're aiming to do is to create these things without having to do too much physical cutting. So you can do these things with lasers. So say you might use a laser to cut out different shapes with lithography. But with nanoparticles in a chemistry wet lab, you can just create them in a solution so that you get quite a lot of particles that are the same size and have the same properties and have turned out the way that you want them to be. So you can actually, we make a pyramidal or bipyramidal, so it's like two pyramids stuck together with the flat side stuck together, and that solution is brown colored, but we make them from gold by starting off with a little bit of silver and gold, and then we add stuff to it so it grows, and then we use acid to kind of etch off little bits of silver. So the way that the crystals form, the crystals forms induce the shape, the final shape of the particle, and so we use those properties when we're generating those particles, and that's, so it's very clever sort of materials chemistry, but at the nanoscale.
So to put this into context for maybe people who might be still a little bit confused about how small this is, a nanometer, one nanometer, is an example from nano.gov. It's how long your fingernail grows in 1 second. A sheet of paper is 100,000 nanometers thick. So it makes me think about a paper cut. It was certainly at least 100,000 nanometers thick, or maybe a little bit more.
Exactly. Or you could think of it like, I think one of our favorite measures is the width of a human hair. So it's what, maybe a thousandth or less the size of a human hair, maybe even 10,000th, 1/10,000th. It's hard to say that word, isn't it?
It is. Well, because we're talking about so many numbers that are so small, like if you go and ask Google how big a nanometer is, they'll just give up and they'll say, you know, 1 × -(-9). They're like, it's 1 billionth, but they just give up. How do you know that they're there, though? Are you looking in a microscope?
We could use electron microscopy to visualize them. And that's actually one of the nicest things I find, is that when you've made a nanoparticle and you can look at it under an electron microscope, and then you see all these beautiful particles that are a lot of them, like say about 70 to 90% of them, are similarly sized within a really good range. And they have like bipyramids, have a beautiful shape with smooth facets and stuff. And you can have stars that are very spindly and spiky, or you can have stars that are shaped like stars that we draw. The spherical ones are not always so beautifully spherical, but they're mostly, you know, spherical. So you can also make tiny capsule-shaped gold particles as well. So it's just amazing that you can sort of look at, you can create these things in solution. You can examine them under an electron microscope, because an ordinary light microscope just isn't strong enough. It doesn't have the magnification for it. But you can also use things like spectroscopy. You can use electrophoresis and a whole bunch of other ways to detect them.
Hey, did you know about the Strange Loop Conference? It brings together over 2,000 software developers for an educational and inspiring experience. You can see talks like Monitoring Traffic in Space, Behind the Scenes of the New York Times Crossword, Securing Cloud Applications, Building an Open Source Pancreas, The Science and History of Color, Voice-Driven Development, Probabilistic Programming, the computers of Voyager and Grammy-nominated recording artist Imogene Heap. Strange Loop 2019 takes place September 12th through the 14th in St. Louis. Get your tickets now at thestrangeloop.com and use discount code Hansel, H-A-N-S-E-L, for $75 off. When was the first time that you kind of fell in love with this? How did you fall in love with small things like this? And was there a long time before you actually saw one? Or did you see one and say, oh, this is what I want to do?
Well, I was actually working in cancer research, in cancer immunotherapies, actually. So we were working on a molecule called CD73, which we found was involved in breast cancer development, and also we think might be implicated in prostate cancer development. And we basically generated a therapy, and certainly our work was in animal models, but it's now there is a human version of what we created, and it's in clinical trials. I thought, you know, it'd be really interesting to see if we could deliver these therapies better in a more direct way, directly to cancer cells. And so I was aware that this is something that you could do with nanotech. And I was interested in creating better delivery mechanisms for cancer therapies because, you know, for cancer therapies, a lot of the ones that we're familiar with, like chemotherapies, are actually quite toxic to the person who's receiving them. They make you very, very sick because it's a side effect because things like a doxorubicin, for instance, chemotherapies target fast-growing cells. So cancer cells are cells that our body produces that have evolved in a way where they divide very rapidly as well. And so that's why, you know, they consume so much. That's why people get very sick. So when you give people a chemotherapy, it targets, obviously it kills off cancer cells, but it also kind of circulates through your body and then it kind of affects other fast-growing cells, which is why people have their hair fall out, why they become very, very sick. And, you know, to kind of avoid that, what we want to make sure is that where possible, we get chemotherapies and other therapies as much as possible, direct them only to the cancer cells or primarily the cancer cells so that the effects on the patient are far less severe and it makes, you know, recovery a lot easier. So I figured that nanotech was one way of doing it. And so the opportunity to carry out this research in trying to develop nanoparticles that could deliver therapies, and in my case specifically gene therapies, to disease-causing disease cells came up. So that I ended up pursuing that. So I really just wanted to make sure that we could be better at delivering drugs.
Mm-hmm. That's really exciting. My wife had cancer, and of course she's okay. But the treatment was it was effectively napalm, isn't it?
It was horrendous, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, let's just blow all of this stuff up, and we'll hope that in the ensuing melee, that the cancer was involved in some way.
Absolutely, exactly.
Yeah. And the thing is, though, there's always, you know, in the movies when there's an explosion and the bad guy there's always a bad guy who jumps away from the explosion and runs away. And that's what happens with cancer. Like all you need is one cell that didn't make
it. Exactly. Because you know, there are massive cells that have rapidly evolved and they're rapidly growing and they're mutagenizing a lot. There's a lot of things that have to go wrong for a cancer cell to form. And then a lot of things for it to keep growing and to be maintained. But because there's a constant, you know, genomic mutagenesis happening within the cell, there's a lot of change happening within the cell, within the cancer cell genome, that it means that it can become resistant. So there might be some cancer cells that might survive the process of chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be depressing here, but in some cases,
not at all.
You know, that's what happens. And so they become resistant to a chemotherapy, which means you have to use something else to treat, or you have to use different chemotherapies to treat them. And that's why cancer is so difficult to treat, because of this ability of cancer cells to evolve, to kind of evade. They can evade the immune system. They can become resistant to certain kinds of therapies and so on. So it's trying to attack it with whatever we have in our arsenal, from chemotherapies, but making it more specific, using other therapies like immunotherapies and so on. And what it looks like will be the most effective is to use combination therapies, which is not just chemo, but a whole bunch of things to treat a cancer.
The scale and size is so extraordinary. When you first, I'm trying to explain this to my children, the idea of an order of magnitude, right? Like being 10x bigger or 10x smaller. Yeah. So DNA itself has a diameter of about 2.5 nanometers.
That's right.
But like a bacteria is three orders of magnitude larger. Mm-hmm. So if you were going to create something, some kind of nano vaccine, or put some kind of a nanoparticle together and then put something pharmaceutical into it, these particles are going to be, if I understand correctly, smaller than the cells. They're like little minions that jump on top of the cells and then deliver their package.
Is exactly. That correct? Yeah. So it looks like that from a lot of the research done so far, and because I work on gold nanoparticles, I talk about gold nanoparticles a lot. It's become evident that, you know, a nanoparticle has to be a certain size. It's got to be, have a certain kind of surface chemistry that will make the cell notice it and pick it up and take it inside the cell, which is what you want it to do, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're trying to deliver something to the cell. So you want the cell, you want it to go to the right cell, first of all, where possible. And then you want the cell to go, hey, I'm going to take you because you've got this receptor or you've got some kind of signal on your surface that says that I should absorb you. So I should take you in. And so it takes it in using its kind of entry system, its own particular entry system.
Mm-hmm. Are these things small enough to evade the immune system?
Not necessarily. So that's part of the technical challenge of creating these things. So, you can get something inside the cell, but you don't want the cell to think of it as a molecule. It's got to be big enough to fit all the molecules that you want on there. And so on. And then the immune system might still recognize it. So it's at the kind of at the molecular level. What you're doing is you're creating things that are similar to macromolecules produced by the cell, but they happen to be made of metals or they happen to be made of polymers or all sorts of other things. And, you as a scientist have spent time generating the structure, and you can only hope that the immune system doesn't detect it. Or we can sometimes coat the particle with things so that we can stop the immune system from reacting to it. So we can only do our best, and that's part of the whole testing process, but that's certainly something that we have to consider when we're making our particles.
When you put something in someone, you do lots of nanomaterial safety, you do toxicity testing in vitro, but when this is introduced into the body and it does its job, is the particle still around and then it needs to be ejected, or body rejects it and flushes it?
So what we found so far is that some studies find that nanoparticles pretty much just are evacuated by the kidneys. In other instances, they might actually end up collecting. I'm not sure. They might be collecting in the liver, but because the quantity is so tiny, it's not toxic. But basically, so far, they seem to be they're not too toxic, and that's one reason why we use gold, because it's non-reactive. It doesn't react that much with other molecules. If it's in the bloodstream, it will just pick up protein, seroproteins, and they'll just stick to the gold, and, the gold keeps going happily around the bloodstream, but they can be cleared through renal clearance or the kidneys. So when we make our particles, we do have to take that into consideration too, because most of our early testing is just done in vitro. And then when we go through the animal models, that tells us a little bit more about that. So to get to the point of testing on humans means you've already done a whole bunch, but it still doesn't guarantee that it will work in humans.
Mm-hmm. Is there any concern, in the movies, nanotechnology always ends up multiplying, because if it doesn't multiply, we won't actually see it, right? It'd be too small.
Right.
Could you build something that could make more of itself?
So this is, I think, the idea of grey goo. And, we can make tiny nanorobots, but the way that people might think of a tiny robot is they might look at a transformer or a simpler version of a transformer, a small robot, like a toy robot, and then it's shrunk to the nano level, but it's at the nano size. Mm-hmm. But really what tends to happen is more along the kind of molecular motors So back, I think it was in 2016, the Nobel Prize was awarded to chemists who created the first molecular motors. And these molecular motors functioned like motors, but they were made of large sort of branching carbon molecules, branching, you know, rings and things like that. But they functioned like motors. So you have to think of nanobots as probably looking, functioning a bit like that. They're not made of arms and legs, tiny arms and legs that have clung together, but they function like a molecule in some way. It's just they happen to be a large kind of molecule with other bits on it.
These aren't like deeply sophisticated, you know, robots as they are kind of automatons?
Yeah, that's right. They'd sort of be more like automatons. And at the same time, you're expecting that these automatons will function so perfectly that they will be able to take any energy and consume anything from the environment to keep replicating themselves. And in a way, you're basically saying that you're trying to create a nanotech version of a a perpetual motion machine. And we know that a perpetual motion machine is only, you know, it's not actually possible because you will always lose energy in some way or another. And the conversion of energy is never perfect. And so that applies to nanobots as well. So I think it is highly unlikely, you know, I can only say it as a scientist, it's highly unlikely rather than impossible, but it's highly unlikely that we will be able to create that and end up with a planet covered in grey goo.
Yeah, I worry about that, but now I won't worry anymore.
Don't worry.
It sounds like it, certainly the scale wouldn't work, but where would they be getting all their energy from? And they'd eventually just
putter out. I mean, yeah, they'd have to function like small living things, but even living things require certain things to be, you know, it requires certain conditions, depending on what kind of organism they are and so on, to reproduce themselves. So if you want to create an artificial life form effectively, but using inorganic substances like metals, you're going to have as much as a problem as a living thing.
So it sounds like what I've learned today is that nanotechnology is really kind of, it's very multidisciplinary because there's material science people doing tiny things, there's biologists doing tiny things, people doing medicine, and it might be difficult to separate that from the other sciences because it's such a fun word to say, but you could be a nanotechnologist in a number of fields.
You could use, what I would say is rather than saying you can be a nanotechnologist in a number of fields, I would say that you use a number of fields to be a nanotechnologist.
I like that.
Right? So what I do is slightly different to what my colleagues in my PhD lab, so I'm actually in a different lab at the moment where I work on endometriosis now, but my PhD research, most of my lab works on electronic skin. And a lot of them are chemists and some of them are chemical engineers. But they work on electronic skin, and so they're trying to replicate a living tissue using inorganic materials. Whereas I try to use inorganic materials to deliver something to living tissue. But we're all nanotechnologists.
Okay. Right? That's very clear. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, so basically what nanotechnologists largely do is create new materials and new devices using the properties of materials at the nano scale. And we also try to replicate biological functions using inorganic materials. So we're trying to replicate them artificially.
Fantastic. One of the other things that I want to make sure that people follow in closing is a project that you have called Real Scientists. And everyone should go to Twitter/Real Scientists. It's got almost 75,000 followers. And this is a really clever idea. You're introducing us to real science from real scientists. Is this who runs this account? Is someone different every week?
Yeah. So what happens is, Real Scientists was an idea of my friend Bernard Keeley, who works in IT. And another friend of ours, James Smith, and we saw James tweeting about science on a rotation curation account. And we thought, well, Bernard thought, well, why don't you just have a different scientist every week? You know, different national accounts have a different, say, at Sweden has a different Swedish person. So we thought we'd start with that, and we thought it'd be a good way of getting people to talk to scientists with fewer barriers. We want people to be able to ask scientists questions. We want them to engage with them. And we want people to also see what kind of careers that you can have as a scientist, what kind of, you can do a science degree and not stay in science, or you can start out as a beautician or someone in advertising and end up in scientific research, which is what some of our curators have done. So we wanted to display the variety of careers and to also get people to stop being afraid of asking questions and to ask the questions they've always wanted to ask scientists. So we have a different person on every week. A few months ago, we had a group from NASA GIS, and they were in Iceland looking for extremophiles. So we got to see that live as they were in Iceland. Another time, we've had people who are working on when Cassini disappeared into Saturn. We had people talk, we had planetary scientists talking about what was happening. So that was pretty cool. And this week we've got someone who works in science policy and is actually involved in science policy with the US House of Reps.
Rock on. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I'm really enjoying about it is I'm noticing that some of the scientists that tweet at Real Scientists, if you go in to look at their actual personal accounts, they may only have a few hundred followers and they may be hanging out on science Twitter. So I wouldn't ordinarily bump into them. But because your Real Scientist account has such a wide reach, it's introducing me to people, and then I can go and follow them after they're done with their week on Real Scientists.
Exactly. You could keep following their adventures if you'd like. So the people who are behind this account are Helena Ledmere, Jens Fowell, Sarah Faber, Fatima, and a whole bunch of people involved in this. There's a lot of us working behind the scenes to bring this to you every week. So I just wanted to kind of acknowledge them and apologies for forgetting some things.
No worries. Well, shout out to them. And I would encourage everyone who's listening to check out Twitter/Real Scientist. And thank you so much, Upuli Divisekera, for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.